myself and leaving the investigating up to us.
I'm taken aback. I've never needed counselling myself. I bite my tongue and think for a second. If I had something that proved it, something that removed the doubt, then confidentiality wouldn't be an issue at all. Right. Well, I'll leave it with you.
And to give you peace of mind, I'll make sure we take a closer look at everyone coming and going from your place of work,
he says. Thanks, I say, before hanging up. I gently tap my phone to my forehead. I don't like this, I think. I don't like this at all. Cormac enters the practice. His stubble is a little shorter, tidier, and his cheeks are red as though he's run here.
Made it just in time. I got held off at work.
That's fine. Come through. I lead him to my room, and he does his usual routine, eyeing my bookshelf, running his hand along the spines, before settling into his seat. I fill both the glasses of water before placing my pad on my lap and glancing over my notes. So, in our last session, we were talking about when you arrived in Australia, how hard it was to adjust.
We came over when I was young, not long after what happened with my dad. Mum was sort of broken, you know. She was vacant. I can see it now. Stressed, no money, two kids. It would have been hell for her. 'Twasn't long till she started to dabble more in drugs. After what Dad did, it's hard to blame her.
I flick back to a previous note from our first session. Doesn't blame his father, blames outsiders like the mistress. It's not uncommon for people to self-medicate when they have young children and no support network. I can't help but think about the glass of wine I've been having most nights this week.
That's it. No support network.
It wasn't the move. It was the fact Dad was gone.
He was a bastard to her. But sometimes I wonder if she didn't regret it all, trying to leave him in the first place and taking us kids.
So you think she's somehow responsible herself?
No, I don't know. She let us down when she got here. It's hard to look past that. Anyway, we arrived. I was bullied a little for my accent, but an Irish accent is a stubborn mule. When it's there, it's not easy to get rid of. My sister copped it as bad. She was bullied too, but girl bullying is different. Girls can break each other down psychologically, leaving scars that stay for years. My sister is 17 now and she's still messed up from everything, even more than me.
Let's circle back to that later, Cormac, I say, glancing at the clock, changing tack. Maybe for now you could tell me about any other changes in your life lately. How is work?
Work? He says, well, it's good. It's great, actually. My personal life is fine, other than I've had a dodgy bastard hanging out in the alley behind our flat.
That's not good, I say. I want to know about the girl, his relationship. I want to know why he hasn't mentioned her. So are you making friends through your new job? I give a small smile.
Don't, he says with a rueful grin.
Don't what?
Don't you do that smile, don't you dare. I find my smile growing now. I try to swallow it, push it away, but I can't.
What smile? I just want to know if you're making friends, that's all.
Oh, you have a way about you, don't you? One look and you can suck the thoughts right out of my head. One look and you could do anything to...
I raise my palm. That's not appropriate, Cormac, I say, ripping that line of conversation up by the roots.
All right, he says. I'm sorry, I can't help myself. Well, to answer your question, I did meet a girl, actually. The barista and me are in the middle of a fling, I guess you would call it.
A fling?
A fling, yes. She's fallen pretty hard for your boy.
And you? How do you feel about her?
It's not her I want, he says. His eyes are boring into mine. That smile, all lips, dimples, shining eyes. I think about Peter, about how close I let him get and how it ended. Then I think about Gabe and my family and my career, and that sinking feeling I had when I called Sims comes back. I don't want to lose control of the situation with any of my clients. Not Joe, not Cormac. So, I continue, ignoring the implication of his words, you're leading her on.
Am I like your other clients, Margot?
He asks, ignoring my question. I take a sip of my water, swallow hard, shift in my seat to pull my dress a little lower. We're not here to talk about my other clients, Cormac. We are here to talk about you. I place my pen on the page, then meet his eyes again. Let's go back a bit here. Tell me more about this man in the alleyway. Are you concerned it's the same man you told me about last time? The man that followed you home?
I'm not sure. I doubt he's the same person. I just figured the guy who followed me was a pervert or something. I wasn't worried. I can handle myself.
I'm sure you can. Where did he follow you from?
Well, from near here.
My intestines curl into knots. Joe.
I didn't notice at first, he continues, but he was there every time I looked up until I got home.
What did he look like?
Normal enough. 40s. Bald. Can't remember what he was wearing.
That evening, I get back to the house we're renting and find July and Gabe watching TV in the lounge.
Where's Evan? I ask, putting my bag down on the table.
He's up in his room, July says. Been up there for hours.
Gabe bought him a new computer this morning. Another thing I hope the insurance will cover. As long as it's the same model so they can't deny the claim, Gabe had promised.
Is he gaming?
July turns back to me and shrugs. I see pots boiling away on the stove. I climb the stairs and knock on his door. There is no response, just silence on the other side of the door.
Evan?
I call. A few more seconds, then I knock harder.
Evan, I'm coming in.
I push the door open. The curtains are closed. I scan the dark of the room. I can see he has put a poster on the wall to make it feel more like home, and his computer is all set up in the corner. Then I see a shape in the bed.
Evan? I say, what's happening here?
It looks like he is sleeping, the brown curls of hair against the pillow, the points of his bony frame shaping the peaks of the blanket. Then I realize he is moving, but not with normal breathing, more of a shivering. I reach out for his shoulder, pulling gently, but he doesn't turn towards me.
Evan?
Go away,
he mutters, with tears in his voice.
What is it? What's wrong?
He lets me pull him, gently turning him. In the glow of the streetlight coming through the curtains, I can see the shine on his cheeks. I feel anxious more than sad. He's never like this. Something has gotten to him. Evan, tell me what's wrong.
I can't,
he says. It doesn't matter what it is, Evan. I can help you. I imagine all the things that could have gone wrong. My boy is too delicate to have done anything that would warrant this sort of response. Too young to join a gang or have a pregnant girlfriend. But everything is so much bigger in your head at that age. Evan, you're going to tell me why you are upset and we are going to work it out together.
It's my fault,
he says. What's your fault?
The fire.
The tears are clearing now, but his voice still trembles.
Nonsense. Someone pitched a bottle through our window. How is it your fault?
It was Ray's.
Ray's? I say. I've heard the name before. He pulls himself up, sitting against the headboard. I reach for the bedside lamp, turn it on, and he squints against the light. Last time we banned him from his computer for a week, he was teasing another gamer online. Evan, you've not been bullying that kid online again, have you?
No. He's just another player.
It's all I can do to keep from rolling my eyes.
He made the others in my clan kick me out and he took my place. That's why I joined another clan.
I draw a long breath, assessing the situation. I can't tell him that this is all frivolous, that the real world is outside, that the internet is intangible, irrelevant to life. Because it's not true. The cybersphere is as much a part of the real world as anything else. But still, I feel frustrated. So, Ray's kicked you out. How does that make you responsible for the fire? I think about the word, raise, to level or destroy. It's a coincidence, surely. Evan's gaming alias is probably Destroyer or Hellbringer.
When I joined another clan, he told me to quit or he would dox me, but I didn't quit. Then he said he knows where I live. He said he was going to SWAT me.
I have no idea what any of these words mean, but they don't sound particularly threatening. What is dox and SWAT? He sniffs, tilts his head forward.
Dox is to reveal someone's real identity and personal details online. I stream so people can see my screen and my face, but that's it, nothing else.
Well, how would he do that?
Hacking, usually. Well, there are other ways. But tracking my IP address, he would know our suburb. Then using screen grabs from my streams and trying to match my face to photos on other people's Facebook and Instagram pages, especially tagged at local places like restaurants or parks.
He's talking about my social media accounts in July's. Not Gabe's, I note, because Gabe is absent from the online world. The only information you will find there is his short profile on the webpage for Moore and Wansbone Accountants. You're much more likely to find Gabe reading a book or a newspaper than staring at his phone.
What do you mean by swatting? Swatting is when people call in a serious crime to a police department and they give them another gamer's address. Then police storm their house and it often comes up on live streams. I was worried that would happen, but then what happened was worse.
Oh, Evan, I doubt that's the case here. Ray's, whoever he is, probably lives in another country.
He doesn't. He lives here. He told me he lives in Melbourne. I know he lives in Melbourne.
How could you possibly know that?
I just do,
he says. Still, that doesn't prove anything.
I've been careful since then. Always using a proxy server to hide my location. I have location services disabled on my phone and computer. I make sure there's nothing behind me when I'm streaming.
That's good to hear, that you're being careful. Like I said, I'm sure it's a coincidence, although there have been far too many of those lately.
There was something else,
he says. What? He gets out of bed and crosses the room to his computer monitor, switching it on. I see the dark tones of the gaming profile, an image of Evan's character, a Herculean figure with a bare chest, a long rifle slung over his shoulder. He clicks the direct messages tab, and my stomach falls through the floor. Next time, you won't escape. Wink. 12. Evan. I say, trying to keep my voice calm. This doesn't mean anything. Even if it's true, it doesn't mean it's your fault. The fire was in the news. He could have seen it there. Or maybe he meant you won't escape on the game? I'm suddenly angry at July for posting the image on her Instagram and Snapchat. He folds his arms, but neither of us turns away from the screen.
He's a psycho, Mum.
Maybe, but we're safe now. I see other messages in his inbox, messages Evan has sent. We're going to rape you. KYS loser. Evan, did you send those messages? Despite the dark of the room, I see his cheeks flush. Tell me.
Everyone talks like that online.
We've been through this. This better not be the same kid you were bullying with your friends before. He just shrugs. Which gives me the answer. No wonder he feels guilty.
It's just how people talk in gaming. It doesn't matter.
That doesn't make it right. What does KYS mean?
It's just something people say.
My voice rises. What does it mean?
Cool yourself.
My anger boils over.
Are you insane, Evan? What the hell is wrong with you? Never send that to anyone ever again. Do you understand me?
He nods.
Sorry, Mum. People send worse stuff all the time. People say they hope I get cancer or they're going to throw acid in my face.
You're not sorry, or you wouldn't have done it again. Wasn't it enough we banned you last time? Do we need to take all your gaming away?
No, I won't do it anymore.
Kill yourself. I think about the words again.
What would happen if someone actually did kill themselves? How would it affect my son?
And you sent these messages to this Raze? You provoked him? How could anyone tell someone else to kill themselves? I expected so much better from you.
He started it.
I don't care if he started it. You walk away. You block him. Have you been streaming yourself since we started staying at this house?
No.
Did he definitely know our address before? Did he tell you? He turns away from the computer, his eyes finding the ceiling as he thinks.
No. He never said our actual address. He just said he knew it. He said we had a big weatherboard house.
That's how I would describe 80% of homes in the southeast of the city. I reach for the mouse. How do I log off? How do I block him?
If he's good, he would have worked out the IP already. But that doesn't mean he has the address, probably just the suburban ISP.
So it's easy to do.
Easy enough.
Have you done it to him? He looks guilty in the screen light.
I have his IP too. Well, he uses a couple of different ones, but I know sometimes he's down near Pakenham somewhere and sometimes he's near the CBD.
Pakenham. I know Joe lives close to the city, but maybe he also has a house down there.
I'm going to call the police.
No,
he says. Please, Mom, don't make him angry.
Don't make him angry. Have you seen him angry before?
Last time he spammed me with images, the most messed up images on the net.
Joe. I lower myself onto Evan's bed, the possibilities flying through my mind. I'm up late playing games, Joe had said. I assumed he meant games on his phone, but what if he meant the games Evan plays? What if Joe didn't even know I lived there? Or worse, what if Joe started seeing me to be closer to Evan, knowing I was Evan's mum? Now that I think about it, I've never verified that Joe works for Rad. He pays for his own sessions and is supposedly reimbursed by the company. Everything I know about him, he has told me. Other patients reported being followed. Is it a coincidence? Or perhaps Joe really is sick? Perhaps he's a voyeur who got bored, who wanted to make his own drama. It's a coincidence, Evan. I say, if you're right and this person is involved, the police will find him. But that would mean it is his fault. And not yours. You understand that, right? He nods. Good. In the future, don't be so stupid as to provoke these sickos, I say. Now, I want you to come downstairs when you're ready and spend some time with us. Dinner will be ready soon. But at the table, I can barely concentrate on my food. Evan doesn't eat much either. He's worried sick. After dinner, when the kids are on the couch in front of the TV, I decide I can't wait any longer to talk to Gabe. I approach him as he's doing the dishes. He's just dried a pot and is opening drawers, trying to figure out where it came from. I touch his shoulder, and when he turns back, I point up and nod towards the stairs. He takes the tea towel from over his shoulder and tosses it on the bench, then follows me out of the open kitchen lounge area up into our bedroom.
What is it? He says, closing the door behind him. It's about the fire. Evan is worried it was one of his gaming friends. I begin. I explain the situation, the message Evan received.
He was crying real tears?
Yes, real tears. He's obviously shaken up, carrying around this guilt for the past week.
Shit. That's a heavy load for a kid to bear in silence. No wonder he broke down.
It's not just that, I say. There's a client I'm seeing. He's a gamer. He drives a white Toyota. He drinks Chivas Regal and sees any number of disturbing images every day in his job. I can see his jaw working, chewing on this new information. His head tilts a few degrees, suggesting he's skeptical.
And you think it might be this guy, this client?
Well, I'm convinced, actually.
I spoke to Sims.
The skepticism slides from his face, replaced instantly by frustration.
Do you think that might be just a little irresponsible, Margot?
He manages to keep his voice even.
Irresponsible? I'm protecting our family. I only asked for advice. I didn't identify the client.
He blows his cheeks out.
I just wish you had talked to me about it first. I don't think you should be taking any risks over a suspicion.
I think about Joe's words, his dreams of hurting someone with a fire extinguisher, his drinking, the fact he could rationalize potential violence. But I know I can't tell Gabe this. He's a stickler for confidentiality. When we were first dating, I was dragged through a tribunal. It was early in my career, after Peter. Because of Peter's wealthy ex-girlfriend, the story was in the media. I've been thinking about him so much more lately. I remember that day like it all happened this morning. Suddenly I'm back there, racing toward him, telling myself that no one would blame me, holding my breath, flooring the car to beat a red light. The ringing was like a heartbeat. The ringing was all I had. Finally, he answered, the voice instantly conjuring the man in my mind. Tall, thin, a tangle of dark hair, a little gaunt, yet somehow still very handsome. Peter, it's Margot. I'm on my way.
You're coming now?
Peter said, his voice narcotically slow and calm. I am, yes, the police called me. I paused, gathered my thoughts. I want you to know that I'm with you. Do you understand? We can get you through this. I swerved out of my lane to pass a taxi. A horn blared. My palm ached, clutching the wheel.
Where are you?
I'm in my car right now, driving to your apartment. No one is going to blame you for this. No one is going to lock you up.
I can't.
A heavy pause, and I wondered what he might have taken. Doctors had a habit of over-prescribing sedatives, SSRIs, sleep aids. His bathroom cupboard was a pharmacy.
What? Peter? You can't what?
I can't continue with this. I can't. You lied to me, Margot.
Peter, you have value. You are loved. I didn't want to mention his family, but I had to. You have a child. And an ex-girlfriend who is pregnant, I could have added. You have a father and a mother who both love you.
They're going to lock me away. You're working with them. It's never been about me, has it? I love...
No. I cut him off. No, Peter, this isn't about me. This is about you. You can't depend on me to feel happy and calm, but I'm here to help. I promised you and I keep my promises to patients.
Patients,
he said. I might as well have said customers. You know what I mean. The people I see. I was thinking of how to keep him on the line, keep him talking when he spoke again.
You did this to me, Margot. You did this.
The line cut out as I got close. I checked my phone to make sure the call was recorded, then I rang him again, but it went straight to the answer phone. He turned the phone off.
Well? Gabe says, snapping me back to the moment. What can we do?
If you knew some of the things this person told me, Gabe, some of the clues, then you would understand.
The police are looking at anyone visiting the clinic, so hopefully they'll check him out. He lowers himself onto the edge of the bed and folds his arms.
Okay, well, I just hope you know what you're doing.
I have an obligation to report serious crimes to the police, but only if I believe that a client's confession is credible. I know I shouldn't speculate,
but all the evidence is pointing to this person. Say it is this guy. What if he knows where we're staying?
I've been paying attention. Even if this Reyes is my client and he has the IP address here, it doesn't mean he has the street address.
I move closer to him, standing before him on the edge of the bed. I rub his upper arms. He softens, unfolds his arms and wraps them around the tops of my legs.
Look, I'm sorry if I'm stressed. It's just an awful position to be in. Part of me was hoping it all was truly random, you know? Part of me was hoping it would just disappear. But if someone has cause to do it once, then what would stop them doing it again?
He asks. It's a question I can't answer.
We've just got to be careful. I don't know what more we can do.
His grip on my upper legs loosens, and I step back to read his expression. He's staring at the carpet at my feet, chewing his lip.
What's the rules with an anonymous tip?
What?
Well, what if the police received an anonymous tip? You shouldn't be talking to the police directly about a client unless there's a credible threat to someone's safety, but if you don't have that and you're certain that it's him, what if I'm wrong?
He clicks his tongue.
The police ask a few questions, then leave him alone. But if you're right,
he'll suspect I put them onto him. It'll get ugly quick.
Or he'll be extra careful not to put a foot out of line. And maybe the police find something that ties him to the fire.
Why don't I call Sims and tell him about Reyes first? If Reyes is the same person as my client, it won't matter.
He thinks for a moment.
That might be a better plan, he says before rising from the bed. I'm going to go finish washing up.
You wouldn't describe Sergeant Andrew Sims as excitable, but he is particularly downbeat when I call him.
Look, this is bordering on conspiracy theory, Mrs. Scott, but as always, I'll note the information and give it due consideration when investigating this case.
Annoyance swells in my throat.
Due consideration? Someone online basically admitted to lighting the fire.
This kind of thing happens all the time. Do you know what trolls are?
Of course I know what trolls are.
Well, particularly sick trolls often target people who have gone through a recent crime. The worse the crime, the sicker the trolls. Some of the commentary surrounding crimes is particularly horrible. I would tell your son to take some time away from this online community and perhaps consider changing his alias.
The point is, Sergeant, Evan's identity should always have been anonymous. Someone at the very least has gone to the trouble of tracking him down. Doxing, they call it.
Again, this is difficult to prove and even more difficult to prosecute. Doxing tends to be releasing private information to the public, not just knowing it. Most of these people are kids, and all we can hope for is a slap on the wrist from youth justice. So unless there is a serious crime, or we can prove a connection, we can't go pursuing everyone online who makes mildly threatening remarks. Again, as a courtesy, I'll check in with the cyber team to see if we can pursue this Reyes kid, but I'll warn you again, do not meddle in the investigation.
Mildly threatening remarks.
The entire exchange has been really aggressive and quite sick, actually. This person hates Evan.
He sighs.
Look, I wouldn't commit too much to the idea that this gamer is the one that started the fire. Last time we spoke, you were convinced it was one of your clients. Which is it?
I've been holding off saying this, knowing it will likely only make him scoff, but I have to put it out there. What if it's the same person? What if he has been doing all of this? My voice grows quick and manic, and I realise how unconvincing this sounds. What if he started seeing me to get to Evan? A light chuckle. He's laughing.
I'll tell you what I told you last time. I think you should take a step back from it all and let us handle the investigation. As a psychologist, I'm sure you can understand why objectivity is important, and you'll only work yourself and your family up.
Objectivity. He might as well call me an irrational woman. I can't rebut his point, though. I'll try not to put my nose in it anymore.
If you would like any updates or have any questions, get in touch. But next time you have a hunch, maybe keep it to yourself.
Sure, I say. Sorry. It's hard not to analyze people when I'm frustrated with them. Now I'm thinking of Sims as someone who grew up a loner, most of his interactions formal, stiff. He found a place he fitted in the police force, where uniformity and obedience are rewarded. He's a little like me in that he knows he must follow protocols and conventions, but unlike me, he's probably never broken them. At night, I find myself listening to the pealing sound of car tires on the rain-soaked pavement, the occasional sound of footsteps, the unfamiliar night sounds of this unfamiliar house. In the dark of night, I lie there waiting for the sound of shattering glass and the crackle of flames. I think about those words and wonder if maybe I really am being paranoid. Next time, you won't escape. 13. Cormac isn't working when I pick up my coffee, but the girl is there, the barista. I stand by the coffee machine. Quiet in here today, I say, looking around the cafe.
It's not normally busy on Tuesdays.
Well, I need my fix, and I love your coffee. She glances up. I can see freckles across her nose, and although I can't see her mouth, her eyes tell me she's smiling. Thank you. I try my best. You've worked here for a while now, I note, casually. Too long, she says as the milk steams. But it helps pay the bills while I slave away studying. Oh, what is it you're studying?
Acting, actually. I'm at Victorian College of Arts.
Great, I say. You've got the looks for it. Not that that's the most important thing, of course.
Thanks,
she says. And her dark eyes tell me she's smiling again. She places the cup down on the counter, pushes a lid onto it, and slides it forward.
Extra strong latte.
Thank you, I say, letting my gaze linger a beat too long on her face before setting off. She still has a petite frame despite her curves. She really is gorgeous. I get to my office and wait for Xanthi. She's usually early, but as the clock ticks toward 10, then past her appointment time, I check the lobby again. Did Xanthi call in at all? I ask Anna.
No,
she says. She's due for 10. Could you call and check how far off she is?
Sure,
she says. I wait. I can hear the quiet murmur of the phone ringing, then Xanthi's voice and a beep.
Voicemail,
Anna says. She moves the mouse, clicks, types. And we don't have a second number for her. I'll shoot her a text message and try her again if she's not here in 5. I've got a bad feeling. A slow simmering in my stomach. In 5, she won't be here either. Something is wrong. I wait out in the lobby, reading over the notes in my pad. All those scribbles about Joe, the little observations I made. I read through his family history. Working class family of 4, father was a butcher, rough but not abusive. Mother was a nurse, public school education, average intelligence. I'm playing games less. I take drives at night. I've been having nightmares. I hear words like these every day from different clients, but they seem so much darker coming from Joe for some reason. I go to the back of my notebook and read through the information I had collected for my lecture later in the year. We diagnose sociopathy by identifying certain criteria, a pervasive pattern of disregard for others, reckless disregard for safety of themselves or others, lack of remorse, indifference, or rationalizing the mistreatment of others. Diagnosis happens in a clinical setting because so few people with antisocial personality disorder are self-aware enough to self-diagnose. There is a test formulated for that reason. High-functioning sociopaths might be curious enough to take it.
although they could just as easily reject the result. I glance up. Still no sign of Xanthi. I continue reading. Individuals with APD, that is the spectrum of disorders including sociopathy and psychopathy, tend to lack empathy and show signs of callous, cynical, or contemptuous attitudes towards the feelings of others. It is a disorder much more common in males than females. The door opens. I glance up, hopeful, but it's the delivery man.
Good morning, ladies, he says. Just a package today.
Thanks, I say, signing for it. I hand it over to Anna. Probably stationery, she says as she tears the tape and opens the box. I'm walking back toward my office when she screams.
What is it, Anna? What happened?
She twists in her seat, finds the rubbish bin and throws up. Rushing to her side, I find myself stroking her back. I don't want to know what is in the box, but I can imagine. I hold her hair back as she heaves. Then she sits up, her eyes watering.
I'm sorry, she says.
I turn, open the box. Blood, cartilage, bones, dead people, photos of dead people. But not just dead, maimed. I close it again, squeeze my eyes shut for a second, but the images are burnt into my retina. I feel nauseous. Shit, I say. Don't apologize, Anna, this is sick. My limbs fill with cement. It's like the image left for me that night, only now they've sent them in the mail, so the box is traceable, I think. So this might not be such a bad thing. There must be CCTV at a post office. I take the box out of sight into my office and dial Sims. I just got a package. A box with images, disgusting, horrible images.
Slow down, what do you mean?
I mean, someone has sent a package to my office and inside a... I pause, searching for an adequate description. Just filth. The most traumatic, disturbing images I can imagine.
A box full of them,
he says.
Right. Someone will be with you shortly. Don't touch it anymore. Maybe close up your office if you can until we get there.
When the call ends, I find my mind going to Xanthi. I tell myself maybe she just slept in. I go back to reception. Take the day off, Anna. Paid, of course. I can feel a tremble in my arms and legs, my chest, like a scream wanting to get out, but I know I've got to keep calm. I've got to support her. If you need any counselling or anything else I can help you with, please don't hesitate to ask. I'll be okay. I can stay, she says, her mouth downturned with the echo of disgust. She can still see the images in her mind. No, I want you to have the day off. Go rest up at home or visit friends.
Thank you,
she says, taking her coat from the back of her chair and pulling one arm into a sleeve. When she's ready to go, she grabs her keys and starts toward the door. They're fake, Anna. I lie.
What?
The images. They're not real. Gore scenes from old horror movies. They look real, but they're not.
I thought so, she says. But I just don't know why anyone would send them.
I know what you mean, I say. She's a grad student. Soon she will be sitting in a seat like mine, talking to people for 8 hours a day.
I'll see you tomorrow, she says, stepping out onto the footpath.
I lock the door and call Xanthi myself, trying one last time. It rings out and her recorded voice comes down the line.
This is Xanthi's phone. Leave me a message.
Xanthi, it's Margot. You had an appointment booked in with me today at 10 a.m, which obviously you've missed now. Please give me a call once you hear this to reschedule and let me know that you are okay. Speak soon. I hang up the phone and sit, waiting in Anna's chair for the police to arrive. I realise then that the image on my doorstep was likely left there before the fire. Maybe someone left it as a warning before burning the place down. Is this box a warning of something to come too? Part 2. introspection.
A man has died after a 3-hour standoff at an apartment block in Elwood overnight. Police arrived in response to a neighbour hearing banging from the apartment and the building was evacuated. The man refused to speak with negotiators and barricaded himself in his bathroom, insisting he would only speak with his psychologist. The man was known to neighbours as someone who had mental health issues. Police are not treating the cause of death as suspicious, and no others were hurt.
14.
It's been 3 days. Other than Sims, the only person I've told about the box is Sarah, the dietitian. I'd knocked on the door to her room between clients and sat down with her to explain what was in the package and why we needed to take extra precautions from now on. The police came and took the package away as evidence, but I assume if they had any leads from it, I would have heard. Sims told me they would dust for prints and attempt to trace it back to the original sender. Until they have the person who sent it, we have 3 new rules at the practice. 1. I open all packages, no one else. 2. We never leave each other alone in the office, which means coffee runs are a team effort if there are only 2 people here. 3. We keep the door locked at all times. Patients press a buzzer and Anna lets them in. The last 2 came as suggestions from Sims. He said they're just precautions, but his advice legitimised our collective fears. I ran the town this morning, but I found myself frightened, always looking over my shoulder for Joe. The fear is irrational, and I know it's pointless wasting energy on it, but some sicko is trying to mess with me. They're trying to terrorise me. Between clients, I put light music on in my office and try to rid my body of stress. I meditate. I go through progressive relaxation techniques, tensing and loosening muscles, until my body aches from the effort. I'm looking forward to my 3 o'clock session. At 3 o'clock, I have Cormac. We were making progress last week, and I tell myself that's why I'm looking forward to it. But I know it's something else. Oddly, I feel like I miss him. Only a little, but I do feel a bubble of excitement. I should call a colleague, another psychologist to discuss this with, but I know what they'll say. Countertransference, emotional attachment. It's not enough of an issue to break off the professional arrangement. I just need to be mindful of it, to counter that bias I have towards him. I think about Joe and the advice I got to end his therapy. That's another decision I haven't made yet. It could provoke him, or it could be me needlessly losing a client if this is all some bizarre coincidence. As I come to the end of my session with Suzette, a bored, self-medicating housewife, I don't hear the buzzer at the door, and consequently, I begin to feel energy draining from me. Cormac hasn't arrived. When the session is up and I go out to the waiting room, I find he isn't there, but he was late last time. Maybe he's working again. Anna, I say, can you call my 3 p.m. and see how far away he is?
Sure.
I stand there listening. This happened with Xanthi, and now it's happening with Cormac. Something is very wrong. Occasionally, clients vanish without another word. Therapy does cost a significant amount of money, and some people would rather disappear than admit that money is too tight for them to continue our sessions. Talking payment breaks the therapeutic alliance psychologists must maintain with clients. But that's not to say money should never come up. Money can, but payment shouldn't. Not until it's over. I trust that Xanthi wouldn't leave without a trace, knowing I would be worried about her. Xanthi's absence was chalked up to coincidence by Sims when I spoke to him, but how many coincidences does it take before they investigate? In a podcast I learned about circumstantial evidence, each piece of circumstantial evidence is like a strand, and when you have enough to form a strong cable, there is sufficient strength to pursue the case in the legal system, even if one strand is weak or a few strands break, just so long as the rest are strong enough. Have I reached sufficiency with Joe? Are there enough strands? Hi, Cormac, Anna says, and I tingle with relief. I'm calling from South Yarra Psych. How are you? A pause, and I can hear him murmur down the line. Sure,
I totally understand. So you won't be able to get in today?
She eyes me, her nose wrinkled.
Okay, Cormac, let me see if she's available to speak.
She mutes the line.
He wants to speak to you. He won't be able to make it in.
Why?
He said they won't pay for him anymore. Should I ask for a late cancellation fee?
Shit. Adam must have stopped funding the sessions.
Okay, no, that's fine, I say. Tell him I'll call him back in a moment.
She'll call you in a minute.
She hangs up. I note his number on a post-it and go into my office where I make the call. Cormac, hi.
Margot, I'm really sorry to do this. I should have called earlier.
It's fine, I say. What's happening?
Look, I can't be seeing you. It's not paying anymore. I think I'm going to try to sort myself out. Get back on my feet and make a plan. Maybe apply to another university. I wanted to pay for the visits myself to keep seeing you because I know it was really helping, but I just can't afford it.
I can hear the sadness in his voice. I'm sorry, Cormac. I don't know what to say.
It's not your fault. I really wanted it to work. I know I'm reckless and self-sabotaging, I know. But I want to make myself better. It seems weird, but I wanted to do it for you.
I swallow hard. That's nice, Cormac. You've come a long way already. You've made progress.
It's not proper, I guess, but could I take you for a coffee sometime? As a thank you. No therapy, just coffee.
Say no, Margot. This is a clear boundary. Psychologists must not socialize with clients. Another voice says, he's not technically a client anymore. That's hardly a viable defense if the medical practitioner's board found out. But they won't. How could they?
Just a coffee and casual chat to say thanks. No pressure.
I exhale. It feels like I would be letting him down if I don't. Finally, I say, when were you thinking?
Well, I was looking forward to seeing you today, but it's probably too late.
Today is fine. The day is almost over for me, so I can meet you after my next client.
Oh, really? That'd be great.
I can feel myself letting go. I can feel myself giving in to something.
There's a place near me, the Pearl?
Sure. Okay. I'll be there at 5:30.
Perfect,
he says. I can hear the smile in his voice. I hold the phone next to my ear even after we've hung up, contemplating in the silence what I have agreed to. My next appointment goes too slowly. Willow is a borderline, a little like Xanthi, except a couple of years older. Willow has a habit of keeping me over the end of her appointment. She is needy, with attachment issues, issues with her parents and no real friends. But today, she's good. You're always looking for signs in your clients, reading their body language and mood. Willow sits up, straight-spined, one knee across the other. I keep one eye on the clock the entire time. I can't concentrate. I'm already there, meeting Cormac. When he said he wouldn't be coming back, it felt like a breakup. The same emptiness, the same longing. He, like Xanthi, has the type of unique psychological landscape that drew me to this field. But what is this meeting? A goodbye? After my final appointment, as I quickly pack up my office, replacing the empty box of tissues, I find myself reminded of my father. Is Cormac like him? Is that why I feel like this? Come on, I say to Anna, who is still at her computer checking the schedule for tomorrow. Oh, are you done? Getting away early, I say. Sensing my impatience, she quickly stands and pulls on her coat. I follow her out the door. I lock up, then walk up the street to my car and fall into the driver's seat. I set the GPS for the Pearl. It's too late to change my mind. That's what I think when I see that I am not meeting Cormac at a cafe, but a wine bar. The Pearl. I should have guessed from the name. Not many cafes are open this late. It's all black steel and big windows, almost hidden, signless apart from the opaque ring decal on the window. You can still change your mind, Margot. But I can't.
just like the home visits to Peter. No, that was different. That was a naive young psychologist working as a case manager for the Melbourne Mental Health Service, a role that was more about checking in with patients who had left institutions than it was about administering psychological advice. Back then it was a rookie's mistake. This is somehow different. This is an experienced clinical psychologist about to engage in a potential breach of conduct. But something else he said sticks. He's technically no longer a client. I peer through the front door, scan the faces of the people in the muted lighting. I don't see him. Good. Not too late to make an escape. Maybe he won't show. But when I turn, I see his familiar shape striding toward me. He's so close, his gaze falls on me and he smiles. Cormac, I say, suddenly nervous. Hi. There's an awkward moment. Do we shake hands? Do we hug? In the end, he simply turns and opens the door for me. I choose a booth at the back corner, dark leather and sandalwood. The type of place where men take their mistresses to drink cocktails. We sit and a waiter materialises.
Still or sparkling?
Still, I say. Still is fine, Cormac adds. The waiter comes back with a carafe of water. He fills the glasses already on the table and places two menus in front of us, then leaves again. Cormac, this isn't a cafe. No, he says, as if realizing this for the first time. I guess not. I walk past this place a lot. I thought they did coffee. They only do wine and cocktails, by the looks of it.
Wine it is, then, he says.
Cormac, I can't be here. I can't be doing this. It was a bad idea to come. I reach for my coat, but Cormac touches my wrist so gently, it's almost painful. The voices are loud, filling the space, so I find myself leaning toward him to hear his words. Just one drink. It's not going to hurt. Remember, I'm not a client anymore. It's just me trying to say thanks. My face grows warm where his eyes are fixed, and there is a prickling at my hairline. I lower myself back into the seat, the coat slipping out of my hand across my lap. I dig my fingertips in at my hairline and massage my scalp for a second. If I'd gone straight home from the office, the first thing I would have done is pour myself a glass of wine anyway. All right, one drink, I say. I look up and realize we are close. I can feel his breath soft on my ear. I shuffle back a little. He smiles and glances down. I follow his eyes to my wedding ring and realize I'm turning it on my finger. A nervous tic I've had for years. If it wasn't my wedding ring, it was my engagement ring before that, but Cormac might read it as something else. I glance about the dark place, guiltily searching for any recognizable faces. You could have chosen somewhere quieter, I say. The waiter comes back, bends, and speaks.
Any questions about the wine list?
No, I'll take a glass of the Backward Point Pinot Noir. I say.
I'll have the same, Cormac says. Good choice, the waiter says, before collecting the menus and receding back to the bar.
So, I say, how did you find out the university won't continue paying for your treatment?
Adam Limbargo told me that he wishes me all the best, but he can no longer continue to pay.
In his correspondence with me, Adam had been supportive of Cormac. So why the change of heart? I sense there is something else at play here. Adam had a gambling addiction, and although it wasn't stated when I met him for coffee, I'm sure he'd lost a significant amount of money. Maybe he's in financial trouble and can't afford to cover Cormac's sessions? The waiter brings over our two glasses of wine. Cormac holds his glass out to me and I touch it with my own, then draw in a mouthful. I'm curious about this relationship, Cormac.
How so?
Were you doing anything for him? Helping him mark papers or something?
No, nothing like that.
I don't know why you wanted to look after me. It took a shine to me, I guess.
I remember Adam's earnest voice when he spoke about his wife. She's at the end of her tether. He was stressed, and in retrospect, it always seemed odd that he would fork out money for someone else's therapy when he evidently wasn't prepared to pay for his own.
I don't know what to say,
he continues. He slides a palm up his cheek and it rasps on the stubble.
He seems like a nice guy. Maybe he thought that if I ever did anything with my life, he would have that social currency. That's why people like him have charity auctions and charity galas, right?
So you see yourself as a charity case?
Well, I am, aren't I? What else would you be doing here tonight?
You're not charity, Cormac.
Why are you here then?
I don't know, I say, honestly. When I was younger, I was much more reckless. I'd always find myself in situations like this, with that feeling that something was immoral, more worried about being caught than doing wrong, and yet I was doing it anyway.
It doesn't matter now. He's pulled the plug.
So he called you?
I actually called him.
Wait, you said he told you he was no longer funding the sessions.
That's right, he says, with a guilty smile. I think he stopped paying because I called him.
Oh, Cormac, what did you say? I just wanted to know when they would take me back to the university. I'd been seeing you and trying hard and he wouldn't give me an answer. We got into a bit of an argument and I may have said some things about him that I didn't mean.
Did you think about me when you did this? Did you think about the work we've been doing?
I almost miss it, but briefly there's a note of sadness, of regret in his eyes. Then it's gone. That charming veneer is back. He forces a smile to his lips. He just started calling me ungrateful, you know?
Cormac, this is what I was talking about. This streak you have of self-sabotaging. You called him for the same reason you wrote other students' papers. You don't think you deserve to be in his class, and you didn't think you deserved his money, so you act out to hurt yourself.
I think you called him to start that argument. He swirls the glass, raises it, and breathes in the smell before taking a mouthful.
I'm worthless. They know it. I know it. The only person in this world who thinks otherwise is you.
What about your sister? What about your girlfriend? What about everyone at the university who knows how brilliant you are? I take a sip of my wine as I wait for his answer. He heaves out a sigh.
The girlfriend is gone. She still texts and bothers me, but it wasn't working out.
That's another thing you've just said about to destroy, isn't it? Another relationship. I stare deep into his eyes. Will that be awkward at work? He gives a small laugh.
Awkward is right. That's why I quit.
Oh, Cormac. I can't help but laugh at the futility of it all.
And my sister? She's becoming more and more like Mum every day. She's acting crazy, always saying someone is outside the flat. She's the one who ought to be seeing you.
She thinks someone was outside of your place?
Yeah, I told you. She's obsessed with this bald man. I think he's homeless, but she swears he's been watching us.
A bald man? Could it be Joe? What would he want with my other clients?
So what about you, Margot? What's happening in your life?
Back to the questions. Always the questions from Cormac. That's what makes him a charmer, because people's favourite subject is themselves. Nothing is happening in my life, Cormac. The same old.
How's the family?
They're good. Can I ask you a question? You just did. A personal question. I take a long sip of my wine. The glass is almost empty. Do you still love your husband? The question is a clean cut, and it sinks in close to the bone. I feel heat rushing to my cheeks. That is not any of your business, Cormac, but the answer is yes, of course I do. I'm sorry, he says with a laugh. I didn't mean to make you defensive. I pause,
my cheeks hot. I think more deeply about the question. Yes, the way someone might love their brother. Yes, but partly because of how much he wants me. Yes, I love the fact I have someone like him. It's entirely inappropriate, Cormac. You know that. I just know there are different types of love, and you've got kids and it's been a long time. I said this isn't appropriate.
Sure. I just wish I had that. I wish I had a woman like you for 17 years, he says, before draining the last of his wine. Excuse me.
He steps away from the table toward the bathrooms. I take a moment to check my phone. I text Gabe. Stuck at the office. Be home ASAP. Sent. Cormac comes back a few moments later. Then, before I know it, the waiter is there with two more glasses of wine.
Oh, no, I say. I've got to go, Cormac. I can't be here with you any longer.
Just another glass, he says. It won't hurt. Text your husband and tell him you're having a drink with a friend. I've already texted Gabe, I say.
Gabe?
Shit, I think. I gave him yet another personal detail. Yes, I texted my husband. Then what's the problem? I take the glass by the stem and have another sip. I can feel it working on me, the blood slowing in my veins. I feel relaxed. I study his face. Those green eyes. He runs his fingers back through his hair. I place the glass back down on the table. If Joe really is Ray's, then he would only be out to get Evan, not any of my other clients. So why am I so worried about Xanthi? You know, Cormac, I've heard there's a stalker in South Yarra. He is bald, a little overweight, and very tall. Maybe you should take extra care. He raises his eyebrows. Is that right?
I'll be fine, he says.
Beneath the black button-up shirts he always wears, I can see the shape of his shoulders, the ropey muscles of his arms pressing the cotton. But he's still smaller than Joe, and it's not him I'm worried about.
And your sister?
All I'm saying is you should both be careful. That's sweet of you, Margot, to look out for us, he says, his voice getting quieter, so I find myself leaning in to hear him. I glance down and find his index finger is sliding up my own. Then he's leaning closer still. Then he moves smoothly and swiftly so our lips are touching. A moment passes before my hand comes up and pushes him back. I jerk my face away. My heart slams.
No, I say. I'm leaving, Cormac. That was completely inappropriate. I'm married.
I quickly glance around the wine bar again, searching for any faces I might recognize, but the room is too dark, and no one seems to be looking our way.
I'm sorry, he says. I couldn't help it. I'm falling for you, Margot. I don't know what it is. There's no excuses. Sometimes, he begins, I feel like I will never escape the shadow of my father. Sometimes, I feel like my impulses are milder.